Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. About a week ago, the latest statewide effort to address Oklahoma's structural budget deficit was announced. And in many ways, it's the most wide-ranging proposal and the most influential group yet with a plan to fix the state's budget. Step Up Oklahoma is a nonpartisan group of business, civic, and community leaders that have proposed a series of revenue enhancements to stabilize the state budget, a series of reforms to increase the state's efficiency, and a proposal to raise teacher pay in the state by $5,000 a year. The group includes the CEOs of Oklahoma's largest businesses, from energy and manufacturing to services, tribal and education leaders, and industry groups. You can view their proposals at stepupoklahoma.com. My guest is one of the members of the group, attorney and former state senator Glenn Coffey, who was the Senate pro tem in 2009 and 2010. He later served as Secretary of State during the first 2 years of Governor Mary Fallon's administration. He joins us today to talk about the group's proposals. Glenn Coffey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Step Up Oklahoma has managed to attract an awful lot of divergent interests within the state of Oklahoma to come up with a set of concrete reforms and revenue enhancements to the state budget. How did this group come together? What was the catalyst? Is it been the failure of these special sessions and the regular session this last year that has got this group together?
I think it's a genuine concern for finding some solutions and assisting the tough job that the legislature and the governor have in trying to battle through these issues. And it really was an organic event. It began with just a handful of people talking about their concern. It led to calling other people, and before you knew it, it was a larger group trying to come up with some solutions.
How wide is that group? I heard this week, actually, the Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association and oilmen are on board with raising the gross production tax. That's been a sort of a sticky point over the last year. How wide is the group that's put these proposals forward?
You know, it has grown daily, and I honestly couldn't tell you the size of it at this point, but yes, OIPA joined OCOGA, the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Association, a group of other energy companies also joined. The OEA, the Teachers Association, joined yesterday, or the day before yesterday. And so it's literally growing daily.
So how did the group get together to kind of come up with a sense of consensus reforms and revenue enhancements?
Well, after it got to a couple dozen people, that group grew each time it met, just met a few times and discussed what were the components that needed to be part of a solution, and after several lengthy discussions came up with the list that's now public.
Could you go over some of the big points of the plan as far as you're concerned?
Sure. So the reforms that are included on the list include modifying the percentage that is required to raise revenue in the state. That's one issue that has led to some of the gridlock in the legislature. There are a number of reforms that are intended to address government structure and efficiency and how it should function. An accountability office that performs forensic audits and goes through each agency in state government to identify waste, fraud, and abuse. There is a proposal that the governor and the lieutenant governor would run as a team. There are proposals related to a number of measures that would go on the ballot related to reapportionment for the Supreme Court so that the districts reflect a proportionate residence, much like you'd have with congressional districts or legislative districts.
There are Supreme Court districts, but they haven't been changed in, what, 30, 40 years?
At least, yeah.
Well, let's go over some of the big items. And first of all, as far as a expenditure from this plan, it's calling for increasing teacher salaries by $5,000 and increasing principal pay. How important is this to the state?
Well, I think the business community views this as a recruiting tool for businesses. It's an issue in inviting professional talent in lots of different industries to come to the state. And so it's important to make that commitment for teacher salaries.
I think the legislature's been talking about $1,000 or $2,000. This is $5,000. That's a substantial raise.
That's right. I mean, we saw some polling this week that said that was a number that had strong support from the public.
Well, let's talk a little bit about revenue. How do you get, you know, right now we've been dealing with about a $700 to $800 million shortfall through most of the budget year. How do you get this revenue to not only, you know, cover teacher raises, but make sure that the budget's in sound state for the next couple of years?
Well, that's the point. It's a shared pain concept. As you probably noted at the press conference, numerous people said there are things about this plan that they didn't like. There is no one person that I'm aware of that likes the whole plan. You know, I came to the table for a lot of the reforms, but the revenues are necessary part of the conversation. And so you have members of the energy industry coming to the table willing to tax themselves. You have a tobacco tax, a fuel tax, a restructuring of the current tax code that doesn't raise rates, but through elimination of numerous deductions, raises a substantial amount of revenue.
Perhaps the biggest set of revenue will be from the cigarette tax. That's a $1.50 per pack increase. We
right.
also are including cigars and chewing tobacco, so all tobacco products and e-cigarettes will also see increases, correct?
Correct.
Now, let's talk a little about the income tax proposal, because it is really interesting, and I think this is an interesting idea, which is something I think the state should have been looking at a long time ago. You're adding two lower marginal rates, 4.6 and 4.8%. It seems like when you're looking at marginal rates, you know, if you make $75,000 or $5 million, you shouldn't be paying really the same effective rate, and which was what our current system was, because nearly any income at all was taxed at the same 5% level.
Yeah, that's right.
You've added to a 4.6 and 4.8% rate, and 5% remains the top rate for higher income earners. What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, this is a plan that Appropriations Chair Wallace and the House had been working on for a long time, and I think the point is that it produces revenue through elimination of deductions, and by adding the two rates, you have people in higher net worth brackets paying a higher rate, but it's more progressive on the lower end, where you actually will see individuals at the lower end. It will put lower and middle income individuals, it will put money in their pocket and put money into the economy.
Now, your proposal does reduce the standard deduction and disallows personal exemptions, and it caps itemized exemptions. But again, at least the itemized exemptions, the way the federal is looking, the only people who are going to be itemizing anyway in 2019 for the 2018 taxes are people with high incomes in the first place because of what's happened on the federal level.
That's right.
So how much money do you expect the income tax adjustments to raise?
Well, the way it's currently drafted, it's about $175 million.
Will most people be paying more, or will be some people paying less because of those lower marginal rates? Or how do you envision the cut line?
Well, I am not an expert on the breakdown by the brackets. It obviously, there are a lot of changes for numerous people. As I said, I think a significant number of individuals in the lower brackets will be paying less. And folks in the upper brackets that are in the income levels of in six figures and higher will be paying more the way it's written.
Now, you're also looking, you mentioned motor fuel tax, a 6 cent per gallon increase in the rate on diesel and gasoline.
Yes.
We haven't raised that tax in an awful long time.
In a very long time. This would dedicate it towards transportation and take the general revenue money that goes towards transportation and put it towards filling the deficit.
Now, will this be in addition to, seems like we passed something that a few years ago, a state question that devoted so much towards transportation and transportation issues. Does this replace that money, or is it?
It's a wash. It's a wash. It just creates it as a dedicated source on a going forward basis.
Okay. You mentioned the oil and gas production tax. You're looking at an increase to 4%?
That's right. Well, current wells would go from 2 to 4%. There are some comments out there from certain members and from certain industries claiming that this is not retroactive, but the one on wind is. That's not true. This would apply to existing wells that are in production that are at 2%. They would move upon the effective date of this, if this legislation were to become law, to 4%, and then all new wells going forward would be 4%.
Hmm. And then after 36 months, they would move to 7%, which
That's
is
correct.
Which is what our gross production tax used to be once upon a time, correct?
It did. The effective rate really was around 4, 4.5% when you looked at the total taxation, but that was the rate.
So out of all these, and I noticed there's also some gaming modernization for Indian casinos and
right.
and some income tax credits that are also moving, but you're looking at about almost $800 million of new revenue. Is that about right?
That's about right.
How will this help where we are at now within state budgeting?
It will fill the current state budget hole. It will provide the revenue to pay for the teacher pay raise. And it also would provide some revenue for the issues that we hear as they're going into session are at issue. The state has lost its federal funding for the two teaching medical school and hospitals, and they're going to have to find a way to come up with that money. There have been supplemental requests from corrections, from DHS and other agencies. The point of this would be to stabilize things on a going-forward basis. I still believe and hope that the legislature should continue to find waste and fraud and make additional cuts. And we've all seen with what's going on with certain agencies in the news that's necessary. But at the same time, just like Ronald Reagan did in the early 60s and when he was governor and 1980s when he was president, there are times when there is a trade-off for conservatives when they're governing for tax increases. Margaret Thatcher made the same choice in the 70s in Great Britain, and I think that's the opportunity here. For people like myself that have fought for those issues, you still have to, if you don't stabilize things for juvenile affairs and DHS and indigent care issues, then you're going to create a real crisis for a lot of Oklahomans. And the point is we need to step up and move the state forward, fund the core services, continue to look for ways to be more efficient with government. But we've been battling for the last, really ever since the downturn starting in 2009, we've made about over 20-something percent in cuts overall to state government. And so we're saying it's time to take a look at these issues, stabilize things, and then hopefully it positions things going well as we begin with a new governor and new leaders in different positions going forward after this election cycle to build on that.
My guest today is Glenn Coffey. He's a participant in the Step Up Oklahoma initiative, which involves a broad-based bipartisan group of former political leaders, business leaders, interest groups, all coming together to put together this package of both reforms and revenue to stabilize state finances. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, of those revenue scenarios, how many of these can get through the legislature? At this point, you're still looking at 75% majorities that you have to reach. What's the chance of actually getting 75% for any revenue increases in the state?
Well, it's obviously very difficult. That's why we're still having the conversation, and that's why this group, who honestly a number of us have said, some of us have been part of the problem in the past and battling over different policy issues that affect the outcome on this, and that's why we're trying to say everybody needs to get in the boat and row the same direction to help them get support in their communities to get the necessary votes, because the group has come together to support the whole package, knowing that the sum of the parts is greater, and that's what we're proposing.
Is the idea that with enough pain shared around that everybody has skin in the game to come forward and provide political cover for those that have traditionally voted no on any sort of revenue increases?
It's a tough vote. I'm sure in some areas it's not politically popular, but it's enough shared pain for the legislature to step up and be statesmen and say, we have to come up with a solution that's not perfect, that there are parts of it that aren't going to sell well back home in my district, but it's still the right thing to do.
Will some of these go to votes of the people, or are you
a number of the reform measures would go to a vote of the people?
Right, but as far as the revenue positions, you hope to accomplish all that through the the legislature with a 75% majority.
That's right. The income tax would only require 51% because it's not a rate increase.
That's true.
But a number of the other ones that we've talked about would.
Interesting. That only requires a simple majority because you're not raising the rates, but you're eliminating deductions and...
You're reforming the code.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well, let's talk about a little bit about some of the reforms. The first one you mentioned, I think, was the lower supermajority threshold, the 75% for revenue increases. That state question 640, obviously, that's a vote of the people.
It is.
So how do you make the case to the public that they should get rid of this supermajority?
Well, we're not asking them to get rid of the supermajority. We currently require our bond issues in the state to be 60%. We're saying that's a good number and a reasonable number. That's still a substantial hurdle to overcome, that when necessary and the public supports an idea for revenue, that it could be done. We're saying, I think it was not anticipated by the drafters of 640 that it would impact where a minority caucus could dictate to the majority what the outcome was going to be. And I think it's created, certainly it's given additional power to the minority caucuses. And I've led a minority caucus and a majority caucus in the Senate. So I've experienced the gambit of emotions depending on what role you play. But you still have to be able to govern and get things done, and we think that's become an impediment to governing.
Now, you mentioned bond issues. That's actually a vote of the people, which requires 60%.
Well, these are representatives of the people. Yeah. We're just saying it's a consistent measure.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about looking at fraud and waste, and oftentimes, even though the health department may be an outlier there, a lot of people talk about finding substantial savings. It's more difficult to find it. How do you anticipate it working? You call for an independent budget office.
Well, it's similar to the concept of a congressional budget office, and it has some independence where it can truly do the audits, do the forensic accounting to identify those issues and bring them to light. I think the likelihood of, because legislators are well-intended, but as part-time legislators, it's really difficult to do the job. I mean, you're dealing with an appropriated budget that's over $6 billion currently. When you deal with all the revenue that goes through state government, it's close to $28 billion. To be able to do the financial management on a part-time basis is a lot to ask for the legislature, and so we just think they need a tool to identify those issues to help them bring those to light and then correct them.
Now, how does that differ from the auditor's office? I mean, the auditor's office is doing audits of various state departments.
This would be on a regular rotating basis where there would always be this deep dive, and it would be geared specifically towards finding that, not just following financially gap principles, but really looking to the operations, the workflow, and if there is waste or if there's a... it's not inconsistent with what the auditor does, but I'd say it's a different purpose, a more focused purpose.
And this also gets to another reform you're talking about is revenue transparency, which revises the budget to actually budget sources of revenue and actually expenditures, where they're actually appropriating, instead of lump sums to departments, it's actually getting a little more precise in where money's supposed to go. Is that correct?
That's right, and that would also enable the system to work the way the constitutional founders intended, which was that the governor would have a budget with specificity, and if he or she chose to do a line item veto, they could. But we have gotten in the practice in recent years of just passing agency budgets without the specificity in the line items.
Mm-hmm. And so there would be a line item budget for virtually every department in the state?
I would think so.
Yeah. You also have a number of governmental reforms. One is to revise term limits, adjusting the term limits for state legislators to 16 cumulative years. Why that change?
Well, I think a number of the members of the group feel like that would result in better governance. It would not apply to any former legislator or to any sitting legislator. It would be prospective in nature, but that's the argument that one of the knocks against term limits when it went into effect was that it affected institutional memory. And I think a number of members of our group feel very strongly that that is in fact what's happened, and they think by lengthening the term, that would change the dynamics in a positive way.
And you're a former legislator. I have to ask you, how long does it take to get the job under your, you know, where you feel comfortable that you're asking the right questions, that, that you really know how government works and how various departments that you might have oversight for works?
It takes several years. And I have to tell you, I spent time in the executive branch after I left the legislative branch. And I had learned a lot in my 12 years in the legislature, but moving to the executive branch and dealing with the things that were outside the legislative purview and the dynamics of the administrative role and going with agencies, I realized that there was a large component I still didn't fully understand after 12 years. So there's a lot to learn about state government. It's complex, and it does take several years to get up to speed.
We've seen, like, in the legislature, you see certain people come into the legislature with one set of views, and then as they're there longer, they realize, and they actually admit to, some of them actually admitted to it, this is, you know, I didn't understand what I was saying earlier. Do you think this is going to help on certain legislators who come in with an agenda, and once they learn a little more about how state government actually operates, it'll provide more experience?
I think knowledge and experience is power. And if you come in with an open mind and learn, I certainly learned that during my time. You come in thinking that you have, if people would just listen to you, you have all the right ideas. And as you talk to people and meet the people in their district, you come to learn that they truly are representing views from back home. And while they may be different from yours, it doesn't mean that they're wrong. They come from a different part of the state with a different set of issues, and that voice ought to be heard.
Well, you also have some reforms in state offices. One would be to reduce some of the state offices we currently vote on, would be state agencies and streamlining agency boards. You would give the governor the right to appoint a state superintendent of public instruction, a labor commissioner, and a corporation commissioners, which are currently all state elective offices.
Yes, that is in the proposal.
What was the reason for that?
Well, we have a very weak, and I would focus on the other side of that reform, which is the governor being able to appoint leadership in the top 6 to 8 agencies in terms of scope of functions of government. And the argument is we have a very weak governor system. You really have to be elected 2 terms to be able to make the appointments on a lot of the boards and commissions to have much of an impact of your agenda affecting those agencies. And the thought is that a governor ought to be able to appoint their people in those agencies, and they're elected and accountable to the public, whether it's as we've seen those changes take place in DHS and other agencies. It makes sense to take a look at that in some of the other prominent agencies.
Mm-hmm. So basically giving the governor the ability to create their own administration from day one.
And
they would have the responsibility, and hopefully they'd have a cohesive working group to make whatever policy recommendations the governor ran on and was elected on, I guess.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. You're also talking about putting the governor and lieutenant governor on the same ticket.
Yes, we are.
Would most of these require state question votes?
They would.
Well, what's the process for getting this in front of the legislature? I'm sure you've already been talking to numerous legislators. What's been the initial reaction from what you're at least willing to share publicly at this point?
I think a number of them are intrigued. They have a lot of questions. They're studying it and want to better understand it. But the group is going to continue to dialogue and on a grassroots level talk one-on-one to legislators and encourage them to file this legislation and support it.
If people want more information about your organization, Step Up Oklahoma, and see exactly who the people are involved in with it and the actual proposals, how do they do that?
They can go to stepupoklahoma.com.
Well, Glenn Coffey, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Glenn Coffey is an attorney, a former state senator, and a member of Step Up Oklahoma, a nonpartisan group of business, civic, and community leaders which have proposed a series of revenue enhancements, reforms to state government, as well as a teacher pay raise of $5,000. For more information on their plan, you can visit their website at stepupoklahoma.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
We are so awash in bad behavior, I've been scouring the horizon for a hero. a role model, anyone to admire. And I found one. Here's how it happened, in a circuitous route. I listen to a lot of public radio talk shows, and late one night I heard a panel of Brits talking about things, and one of them said how confusing she finds the United States health insurance. In Great Britain, she said, everybody has National Health Service, but in the United States, a person's health coverage is determined by the employer. She said, I don't understand that. The employer determines, for example, what kind of birth control you have, or not. Well, I'd never thought about it, but now that I do think about it, I don't understand it either. What's curious is who's in charge. Take egregious personal behavior. Long, long ago, when a person behaved badly, he was chastised by the church. The parson, the priest, elders, the church itself set the boundary for good behavior and established some sort of punishment for bad behavior. Nowadays, that's not so widespread. But for years, the great disciplinarian has been the law. Cross the line and you might be sued. Now that has changed recently. And now the big daddy is the workplace, the employer. Men who have been cited for sexual harassment and bullying have been fired or forced to retire. The really big boss these days is the employer. Wow, I thought. I have identified a societal shift. But wait, who am I to analyze society? That's like having quantum physics explained by Daisy Duck. And here is where I discovered my new role model. Who am I to diminish Daisy Duck? She's pretty cool. It's okay with me that she's not a spring chicken. She's a duck of a certain age. She's been around since 1940, and she's seen something of the world. She dresses with a distinctive style. Not my taste, but color-coordinated, a big bow on her head, a blouse with puffy sleeves, big colored high heels, and a bangle on her wrist. Daisy is no wallflower. Her colors are purple and pink. This duck has some flash to her. Now, sometimes she's criticized for being too glamorous, even flirtatious, but she's devoted and loyal to Donald Duck. And more self-controlled than Donald, who is known for his sputtering temper tantrums. That's his main character feature, his short, explosive temper. Daisy is a good influence on Donald, but she has a will of her own. Nobody is going to walk all over Daisy Duck. Besides, being calm and unflappable isn't all it's cracked up to be. I like the story of the cool-headed piano player. He was playing a concert when someone yelled fire. The audience jumped to its feet and began to panic. But the piano player was so cool-headed, he kept playing calmly. Everyone sat down and was burned to death. Sometimes there is fire in the theater. There's cool and there's cool. I have other role model choices. I might choose Minnie Mouse or even Clarabelle the cow. But I'm sticking with Daisy Duck. She is her own duck, smart, a sharp dresser, distinctive personality, and a good friend who doesn't take any guff off of anybody. What's not to like about a gal like this?
Connie Cronley is a writer and essayist and a columnist for Tulsa People magazine and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.